It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting announced last week that it will cease operations after it was defunded by Congress.
The CPB distributes federal funding to NPR, PBS, and their member stations.
That federal funding represents about 6% of Wisconsin Public Radio's annual revenue, but the majority of WPR funding still comes from listener donations.
There are still a lot of questions about what this will mean for operations here at WPR.
I talked to Wisconsin Public Radio Director Sarah Ashworth yesterday for a look at the impact. A lot of people are hearing maybe the news that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is closing down after the funding cuts from Congress. What is the CPB? What does it mean that it's going to close down?
Right. So the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was founded in 1967. And I just want to pause for a moment, too, and say that Wisconsin Public Radio is the oldest operating station in the country. And we existed before the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So we were on the air in 1967. They formed the CPB. And really, that built up this network of public media all over the country. And they've been the way that has distributed the federal appropriation each year and has been just a really grounding force, I think, in the sustainability and equity of service of public media.
The big takeaway here is there's no money coming now from the federal government, so there's nothing for the CPB to distribute. So the next question, as I talk to people at public events, is, well, what does the loss of that money mean for Wisconsin Public Radio?
Right. And there's, you know, there are different losses that will be felt all over the country. Here at WPR, as most people may know, we work very closely with PBS Wisconsin. We're part of the same team together in providing public media to the entire state of Wisconsin. So when we look at, and we are services of the Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, we have a complex structure that allows us to really provide public service to the state. But taking that into account, so looking across WPR and PBS Wisconsin together, I think is the best way to look at the effect. It's about 10.4% of our budget. That comes out close to $6 million.
Is that something that means, hey, listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio, for the part of that cut that we take, they're going to feel, they're going to notice some differences as we make decisions about what to, how to absorb the impact of those cuts?
I think, unfortunately, yes. And that's, you know, I think for public media consumers all over the country, that is the answer. What we don't know is some of the larger services that the CPB provided, say music rights or some of the different infrastructure. We don't know how that will come together. So then it's not quite known fully what the impact is on the system and then what we will feel. So once we begin to know those things, then we'll be able to assess what our service continues to look like for WPR. We're committed to being here and being WPR on the air and our local service for sure.
You just brought up other things the CPB does. It wasn't just a money funnel. Can you talk a little bit more about the services that it provided and the discussion now of how or whether to replace those services?
Right. And one of the things that is beautiful and wonderful about public media is it is built from the ground up. As I was saying, WPR existed before the CPB. We existed before NPR. So there's no central leader necessarily of the public media system. There's NPR, there's PBS, there's the CPB. There are 1,500 public media stations, TV and radio across the country. So at this moment, what I see is really who steps in to figure out some of these things with the absence of the CPB. So music licensing, for example. NPR has organized a group to look at that involves station leaders. But I think, you know, and PBS as well is looking at that. So it's figuring out who steps in to lead in some of these areas where the CPB was. Is it NPR or PBS? Is it some of the more resourced public media stations in the country? Or is it another entity that comes together?
Another concern is there's a bunch of nationally produced programming, whether from NPR or other public radio institutions around the country that we hear here on Wisconsin Public Radio. What are you watching for to see how these funding cuts impact that content that we air here and whether how we can continue to air it here?
Right. And that's part of the big unknown right now. NPR has said it's very committed to continuing its programming, to finding ways to, you know, absorb the cuts and continue to be that service across the country of Morning Edition and All Things Considered and other programs that it produces. I think, you know, shows that are produced by different stations, for example, we air programs that are produced by New York Public Radio, WNYC. You know, what is the impact on their budget? And then does that affect the programmings that they distribute? So all of this is, you know, a year from now, I mean, I think it will take time for the funding cuts to settle in, for stations to make those determinations and decisions, and then for the impact to come to Wisconsin.
Now, people who follow Wisconsin Public Radio closely will remember in June, we had layoffs, 15 employees, sunsetting shows, much-loved shows here at Wisconsin Public Radio. In those calculations, was that, or this was before those federal funds were cut, but the conversation was there, were those impending cuts taken into consideration as those decisions were made earlier this year?
Yes, I think the threat of loss of funding to the CPB felt very real and felt, how do we prepare Wisconsin Public Radio to continue its service, knowing that that's a real threat? And we did have an operating budget deficit that had started during COVID and was continuing. So we knew we needed to get into a better position to weather whatever cuts might be ahead. And so we are budget-wise in a better financial position going forward because of some of the decisions we've made. Those are, you know, been incredibly difficult decisions because they impact everyone who's a listener. You know, the sound of who we are is affected by those decisions.
That said, that doesn't mean similar things couldn't happen in the future as we reckon with the impact of these cuts. Do I have that right?
That's right. But thinking about our service to Wisconsin, thinking about the programming that is original to this place and made with Wisconsinites, that is our vision going forward. So using that to think about, how do we make sure that our service is very focused on serving communities in Wisconsin will be how we start to make some of those determinations.
We're talking about how WPR could be affected by the end of the Corporation of Public Broadcasting and of federal funding for public media. Sarah Ashworth is with us, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. At the core, I think, of the argument from Republicans who supported these cuts was the idea that, hey, all Americans are providing this funding through their tax dollars, but we Republicans in this case don't feel represented. We feel like there's a bias against us. So why should the public be funding it? What do you say to those concerns that have been raised, not just in this process, but over the years?
I reject the idea of bias in the work that we do. I see the work that you do. I see the work that our news teams in particular do, and the care and thought that goes into representing many perspectives and experiences across the state. And I was a journalist before I was in this role, and I have participated in so many newsroom conversations that have really pushed to make sure that we're fully telling a story. And I also see that if we miss something, if we make a mistake, we're very transparent in correcting it. We're open when we make a mistake, and we bring in another voice. And I think the beauty of public media too is that we produce many things across many different topic areas. It is guarantee that some people will hear things they like, and they'll also hear things that they don't like or that they disagree with. And I think that's okay. I think in the bounty of all that we do, that's okay. And we need our audience and our listeners and our communities to understand that that this is, you know, coverage is not just in 1 hour or one day. It is over many months, many years, where we are helping share the story of Wisconsin.
Do you have a sense that Wisconsin Public Radio and other public media, for that matter, need to do a better job of telling their story?
Sure.
To the public and making those contacts in the community?
Yes, absolutely. And I think you'll see that we have people all across the state who are working in different communities in Green Bay and Superior, Eau Claire, La Crosse, Milwaukee, Wausau, and they are holding events. They're holding community bingo nights. They're holding pint-sized concerts, things that are a space for community to come together, to show up as public media, as part of the community. That's work we're really focused on as well.
What response have you seen since these federal budget cuts came through from listeners, from supporters and other stakeholders?
Well, we've had, it's heartwarming to see sort of the anecdotes of why people are giving. We have seen an increased level of giving, and I want to say thank you so much to people who have stepped up to reshape and rebuild public media right now. It's going to take all of us working together, us here at WPR, working with our communities to sustain this service. So we have seen, we've seen our total number of members creep up again past 50,000, which is wonderful. More than half of those people are sustainers. That really provides a stable foundation for our future. We've had a number of people provide donations, large gifts, smaller gifts. What's really heartening as well is that our number of new members is up. So bringing new people in to supporting public media and being part of WPR, that also is our future. We have a drive coming up as well in September that we will talk about our mission and how we will continue to serve Wisconsin going forward.
And you just used the word mission. There have been many turning points in the history of public media. I think this is definitely one. At this moment, what is your mission? What is your focus for the next couple of years for WPR?
Well, it's really thinking about our sustainability and providing focus to who we are and what we do, why we are worthy of your trust every day, why we are a service that that helps make Wisconsin an even better place to live. You know, that is how we're going to think about our public service and really making sure that we're all dedicated to listening to people in our communities and our audiences and being relevant and not just choosing what we want to do or what has worked at WPR in the past, but really thinking about what is needed in Wisconsin going forward. And for me, a lot of that is also shoring up the sustainability of this organization and finding new ways to do that.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much.
Sarah Ashworth is the director of Wisconsin Public Radio. She was with us to talk about the Corporation of Public Broadcasting shutting down, what impact funding cuts could have on WPR. A note that no member of Wisconsin Public Media's senior leadership reviewed this segment before or after our conversation with Ashworth.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a UW-Stevens Point program trains educators to use ideas of sustainability in their teaching.
Whenever I see an opportunity, I interweave these big ideas, these sustainability ideas, into my classes.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nearly a decade ago, UW-Stevens Point created one of the first doctoral programs in educational sustainability in the country.
It's a program where educators learn how to teach sustainability. In this case, that doesn't just mean environmental sustainability, but a wider concept that includes ethics, community, and more.
But in a time of backlash against efforts to stop climate change and attacks on DEI, how is a program that embraces core ideas of sustainability carrying on?
To learn more about this program, how it's changed over time, we have a roundtable of guests. Aaron Redman is the program director and associate professor of educational sustainability in the School of Education at UW-Stevens Point. Stephanie Renee Payne got her doctorate in the program in 2024. She's an author and associate professor now in the writing program at the University of Southern California. And Tarina Nusanoff is a current student in that program and a biological sciences professor at Seminole State College of Florida. Aaron, let's start with you. What is the main goal of this sustainability program for educational sustainability?
Thanks. Great question. The main goal of this program is to work with
people that are using sustainability in a way to communicate the ideals of social justice, balance with the environment, to a broad set of learners. So it's not just for K-12 teachers, it can be museum curators, community college educators, even politicians. So we use the word education rather broadly.
Now the word sustainability, Erin, if somebody just said that to me, I think my mind would go straight to environmental sustainability. But that's not the whole picture. That's part of the story. Can you talk about what you mean by sustainability here?
Yeah, I actually think of sustainability as this very human idea. And so I have a definition that I often use with sustainability is the morally courageous pursuit of a just, inclusive, and equitable future where humans and the environment both thrive. So it really is about that interconnection and intersectionality where we view the environment also as a stakeholder in our decision making, but it's about the human desire to pursue happiness and joy and to feel safe.
And Erin, how do you translate in that into a class? If I show up as a student, how do we introduce these ideas of sustainability so that I can then apply them in my work as whatever I'm doing, teaching or at a museum or the others you mentioned?
Yeah, so I think that our early classes, our early required courses are in social justice for a sustainable society, and also in the philosophical foundations of sustainability. And the way that I'd introduce them in a class is really first by talking to the students about how they define sustainability and education in their professional and personal lives so that it's connected to who they are and it feels personal and creates buy-in. And then we start talking about how they can model sustainability because this is really about ethical action. It's not just about content knowledge. So our classes try to speak to social norms and procedural knowledge, how-to information, rather than just here are some facts, here's some statistics. We really have moved away from that declarative knowledge piece in our coursework and allow the students to engage in the parts of sustainability that speak to them the most.
All right, now let's turn to a couple of people who have gone through this this program. Stephanie, you, first of all, you're a professional writer, but you're also a professor. You went through this program, graduated in 2024. What got your attention about this? What brought you in and on board here?
Well, I'm always interested in a relevant education, one that would stretch into the 21st century and beyond. One that would be interconnected with the digital age and what's happening in our society and what's happening planetarily. So I think this was of interest to me because I felt it would broaden my sensibility to bring relevance to my students in the age that we're living in.
And then staying with you, Stephanie, when you're working with your students, can you give an example of something you took away from this program that then you're conveying to the people you're working with?
I think an interconnectedness, not just on the human level, but on the planetary level. My students bring me writing that plants are sentient beings and that we are interconnected in that way. And how we treat each other is also connected to our planetary way of being in this world. And that we can see each other in a way that helps us to move forward as a human species, but also a broader care for the earth. And I think those things are really important to me. And that help sort of redefine what it means to be human in this age of all of the digital things that are going on. So as a writer, I think sort of digging into why it's important to connect with one another. And those were some of the things that I think were really important for me to bring into the classroom.
Tarina, you are going through this program now, as I understand it, and then you're a biological sciences professor in Florida. What brought you into this? What are you taking away from it for your own work?
Yeah, so I When I decided that I wanted to get my doctorate, I knew I needed to have a program that I was going to be really excited about to persist through the program. And so I did an exhaustive search of online EdD programs. And this one really stood out for its uniqueness because it was, you know, targeting educational sustainability. And so as I have gone through the program, I have definitely pulled things out of my learning and applied it to my courses. Particularly in my study abroad class, I really have a sustainability focus there. And so I've brought in these ideas of systems thinking and futures thinking for my students by tailoring certain assignments that I have done in the EdD program.
Oh, so what's an assignment you've brought over, you've ported over into your own work?
Sure. So one example is with systems thinking. We did some work or read some articles on how using concept maps can help demonstrate systems thinking. So what I did with my study abroad students was I had them create a systems map or like a concept map of problems that are facing the Amazon rainforest prior to learning much about it and going on the study abroad trip. And then I had them do a post concept map afterwards, and I was very pleased with what I saw. They were able to make many more connections among like the environmental, economic, and social problems of the Amazon.
We're talking about a doctoral program at UW-Stevens Point on educational sustainability. Erin Redman is the program director. Stephanie Renee Payne got her doctorate in the program in 2024. Trina Nusanov is a current student. Erin, there have been a lot of attacks in the political world on things involving climate change and ecological sustainability, and some of the things you brought up earlier. Words like inclusion or inclusiveness might raise some red flags. Doing the kind of work you're doing now in this environment, how does that affect the work you're doing?
It really affects the work that we're doing. But actually, in this program, there's been this positivity in our support of one another that I feel like has grown and deepened our relationships. So all the students in the program share a desire to work towards a more just future, and they feel like that's under attack. So they come into this program, and we are a safe space to share those vulnerable stories, those stories of pain, those stories of loss, the loss we feel right now in terms of our field, our careers being under attack. And so I feel like just sharing the stories together, instead of it being sad, it feels like a powerful form of resistance. And I do think that the relationships that I have with the students now, they feel stronger and deeper because of the depth of emotion we're all bringing to these conversations.
Erin, for someone who might respond to this kind of skeptically, saying, you know, this isn't really part of my reality. This isn't something that maybe I feel should be supported in a public university. What would you explain to them about the value of the work you're doing and how it would be carried on then through the people who complete the program?
Yeah, well, I think sustainability is an interesting concept in the fact that it is in everything that we do. So it's not just an idea. We can make sustainable or unsustainable decisions when we walk down the grocery store aisle. So all of those decisions impact the land we live on and the people that we communicate with and interact with. So we just have to make a decision to say, I still care about my students, my learners feeling included in a sense of belonging and safe. And even if it's not a part of your reality, it is a part of somebody else's. You could have a student in your classroom, or you could have a participant in a workshop come in that feels unsafe, that feels like, wow, like, could I be deported? And just having a program where we're fostering an environment for everyone to have their voice heard, that That is so real. It is such a part of our everyday existence.
And Stephanie, turning to you, how do you try to recreate that environment when you're working in a classroom setting or one-on-one with your students?
Yeah, just to echo what Erin had said, I think this program has helped me more than ever to look at the tapestry of who we are as human beings, that we're not isolated in the singularity of an experience or a certain identity, that we really are a tapestry. We bring color and we bring this beautiful mosaic when we come together. And I think this program has really helped me to understand that and getting out into the field. And I'm like thinking about a class that I took with Erin where we had to interview the Native population or find someone in the Native population to connect with. And that's been an ongoing relationship, the Tongva peoples here in the Los Angeles Basin. And it has helped to broaden and to see the beauty and the threads of what this world is. I think that sort of isolationist and sort of protectionist ideology that happens sometimes when we're afraid can be shattered by programs like this, where we see each other, we learn from each other, and we grow from each other. And it assuages those ideas that we might have about the other when we come together. And so I've really dug into building communities of belonging, getting out in the world, taking theory and putting it in practice by doing things in the community. And I think those are the threads that really help us to thrive on a human level and a planetary level. So we resist that idea that we have to fall apart or protect ourselves, that we can come together to find a beautiful space of living together. And that's the sustainability piece to me, that we can sustain this life if we see each other.
And Tarina, how do you bring those kind of ideas into your work in biology with students?
So what I kind of, take away from this program is to make sure I keep thinking on like the big picture scale. So whenever I see an opportunity, I interweave these, these big ideas, these sustainability ideas into my classes. So like, for example, I teach in general biology too. We go through the groups of life. And so we get to say like the fishes group, instead of just talking about like properties of fish or basic properties that they have, I take a moment to think about and talk about with my students, like, well, why are fisheries collapsing? You know, what are some of the social reasons, economic reasons due to that collapse? So again, I try to interweave it where I can and keep these big ideas in mind with the hopes that my students then carry forward those big ideas as well.
Tarina, it seems like this is a common theme I'm hearing from all three of you, the idea of, hey, getting past the individual and this moment and looking for those connections. Do you feel like you've had aha moments as you're going through this program along those lines?
Absolutely. I see them in myself and I see them then consequently in my students. I remember reading one of the articles in my transformative teaching and learning class, and I had an aha moment while reading the article. I had not the best experience with my master's degree work. It was very difficult. I had terrible imposter syndrome. And just like through reading this article about transformative learning, I was like, oh my gosh, I had a transformative learning experience. Like when I decided to do this doctorate, I was like, oh my God, I am capable of doing a doctorate and finishing it and taking forward that knowledge with me to my students.
Stephanie, did you have any of those aha moments?
I just had an aha moment. And one of the courses that was that really propelled me to join the doctoral program was Ethics of Care. And I was working with incoming first year athletes, football players at the University of Southern California, which is a very big football world. And some of the students were really struggling with being in this big arena. And that class just translated right away, being trauma sensitive and not using trauma in the bigness, but just being in an environment that you're unfamiliar with, being able to have a financial cushion that you've never had before, having your family dependent on you. I was able to not just see the behaviors, but intervene just because of that class. And I just thought that being mindful and aware, again, thinking about the theme of interconnectedness, that I could use language differently. How can I help you? How can I support you to do well in this class? So I think those kinds of moments show me the practical elements that this program just continues to give me, because I use it day to day. I'm always pulling a thread from what I've learned. And it's helped me to continue the learning process.
And we'll leave it there. Erin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Stephanie, thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And Tarina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Erin Redman is Program Director and Associate Professor of Educational Sustainability in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Stephanie Renee Payne got her doctorate in that program in 2024. She's an author and Associate Professor in the Writing Program at the University of Southern California. And Tarina Nusanov is a current student in the program and a Biological Sciences Professor at Seminole State College of Florida. The application for the Educational Sustainability Program at UW-Stevens Point opens September 1st.
Now, here's a bit of news to Wisconsin up your email inbox. WPR has relaunched the Wisconsin Today daily newsletter. Each weekday, our colleague in the newsroom, newsletter editor Jenny Peek, is curating for you the day's top stories from all over the state. Incredible audio segments to check out, feature photos from WPR's photojournalist Angela Major, and you'll find behind-the-scenes conversations with reporters and producers about how we discover, report, and deliver trustworthy news.
There are also opportunities for you to provide feedback and weigh in on polls. You can sign up at WPR.org/newsletters. Stay informed and connected. That's the Wisconsin Today daily newsletter. Get it in your inbox. Subscribe at WPR.org/newsletters.
Coming up, comedian Hannah Berner is a UW-Madison grad, and she keeps a little Wisconsin in her work.
I do have to say, my most specific show is definitely my show when I'm in Wisconsin.
She joins the show that's next here on Wisconsin Today.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Bridget Bowden with a story about a haunted asylum, the last installment in WPR's Wisconsin Road Trip series.
For more than 60 years, the Sheboygan Asylum housed hundreds of patients living with mental illness, developmental disabilities, and substance abuse disorders. The facility closed its doors in 2002, but for the past 6 years, the Fox Valley Ghost Hunters have been offering tours of its abandoned halls. WPR's Danielle Kading tagged along.
Just off a county road in rural Lima, a metal gate bars one entrance to the 275,000-square-foot Sheboygan Asylum. An electric fence ticks every few seconds, and a disembodied woman's voice warns would-be trespassers that they're being watched.
You are currently being recorded.
The security measures are meant to keep people out. But tour guide Anita Colhagen of Sheboygan is taking 10 souls inside for a closer look. She says she's experienced ghostly activity in the building.
My very first tour that I took here as a guest, we were up in the nurse's wing and we heard a lady just start singing and there was no one else in the building.
While the tours may give some a good scare, Colhagen says the reality of the facility wasn't something out of a horror movie. When it opened in 1940 as the Sheboygan County Hospital, its architect called it one of the finest in the region for treatment of psychiatric patients. Siblings Danielle and Josh Lobach made the trek from Milwaukee to check it out.
We've been talking about going to a haunted something forever, and we didn't realize we have something so close.
Josh says he's experienced ghosts before, and he's hoping to see something mind-blowing on the tour. But either way, he says he's intrigued by the building's history.
If I don't see anything at all, it's still going to be awesome.
All right, come on in.
One by one, people filter into the asylum. Soon after everyone signs in, Cole Hagen leads them downstairs into a dark maze of tunnels and pipes. As people turn on their flashlights, she warns to avoid pointing them at bats on the ceiling. At the end of the tunnels, the group steps into a boiler room where she says patients once worked.
Find a spot around, relax. We're going to set up some equipment.
Fellow ghost hunter Kaylee Gerke pulls out a mix of devices that are said to detect spirits through any fluctuations in the electromagnetic field. That includes a REM pod.
So when something breaks that plane and gets closer to it, the louder it's going to get.
That's the sound of the device calibrating, so no ghosts. But Jackson native Haley Losey says she's heard singing during previous tours of the facility.
I guess it's at first a little creepy, but then once you hear and hear things start to happen, it's like exciting. You just want to keep coming back.
Backtracking through the tunnels, the group pauses underneath the men's quarters. Cole Hagen pulls out a spirit box that scans radio frequencies and creates white noise. She says spirits can manipulate the sounds to communicate.
Can you tell me what city we're in?
Hartford.
That did sound like Hartford.
The ghostly voice got the city wrong, but Cole Hagen says this is one of the best spots in the facility to talk to spirits. On the very last leg of the tour, the group heads to the nurse's wing, where investigators say they've heard singing before. Cole Hagen played songs on her phone in the hopes that a spirit may hum along, but no such luck. So she asks whether the ghosts want the group to leave.
All right, ring the bell and we'll go somewhere else. Ready, go.
And for this group, that was the end of this search for the spirit world. Members took one last look through the rooms before filing out of the building into darkness. Danielle Lobach's advice to people touring the facility? Keep an open mind and try not to be too scared.
WPR's Danielle Kading brought us that story on the Fox Valley Ghost Hunters. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Bridget Bowden.
To see all the stops and plan your own road trip, find the series page at wpr.org/roadtrip. This is Wisconsin Today.
Hannah Berner graduated from UW-Madison in 2013, and she says Wisconsin has followed her into her career in comedy. She's known for her woman on the street interviews, her crowd work, and her love of doing the worm on stage.
Here's a taste of Berner's stand-up on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon.
Commercials are like, do you have a fine line? Ew. Do you have a gray hair? Disgusting. Men will never notice you ever again. And I'm like, that sounds so peaceful.
And here's some crowd work Berner did at a show in Wisconsin, talking about men whose job it is to dress up like UW-Madison's mascot, Bucky.
No, this is the thing with the Buckies. They're kind of annoying because they think they're like Batman. Right? Like, they're like, don't tell anyone I'm Bucky, you know? And I'm like, you're going to an ice cream charity event. Like, no one cares that you're that. Are there any Buckies in the crowd right now? Do they like girls be Buckies? Someone should write an op-ed on that. Someone should.
Hannah Berner hosts the podcast Berner Phone and Giggly Squad and is co-author of the book How to Giggle, A Guide to Taking Life Less Seriously. Her special, We Ride at Dawn, debuted at number 2 on Netflix. She's currently on tour and will be in Green Bay on October 25th, Madison on October 26th. Hannah, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
So excited to be back in Madtown over the air.
Now, you are from New York City, from Brooklyn. You came to college at UW-Madison. What was that experience like? Was the Midwestern college town a culture shock for you?
I mean, you can't experience like a true sports college in New York City. That's just not a thing. So when I realized like the whole state was involved with the Badgers, I've never seen like fandom and school spirit to that extent till I went to Madison.
And you were an athlete yourself, right? You played tennis?
Yes, I was on a tennis team all 4 years and then did a fun little half a semester after to graduate. So 4.5, not to brag.
Now, were there things from New York that you're like, oh, you can't get good blank in Wisconsin?
Good question. Let's be honest. The pizza that I love pizza because of cheese. So then when I realized you could just get tons of cheese here, that was amazing. I became like a cheese curd connoisseur. I'm like, do you want it, you know, crunchy? Do you want it squeaky? Do you want it long? Do you want it short? But then I was a big Ian's Pizza girl. I really loved the mac and cheese pizza. I put my Brooklyn stamp of approval on it.
That's good to hear. Now, you worked in media for a while after college, did some reality TV. What led you into the world of comedy?
Great question. I mean, honestly, I loved comedy. Since I was at Wisconsin, I would always go to Comedy on State to see comics. But it was just like a subconscious, like, oh, this is entertaining. But tennis was my whole life. You really don't have a lot of time being a student athlete. And then when I went back to New York City, I had learned how to edit and I was on camera at Wisconsin doing a lot of like sports broadcasting my last semester. I worked for the communications department and I'd been friends with a lot of the athletes. So I had some videos do well where like I interviewed Frank Kaminsky and I was following a lot of the women's sports too. And I remember at like 25, I was like, I miss being on camera. I miss editing. Am I a ham? Like it's not that I want attention. I want to create video. And I saw those old videos and they really inspired me. And then I love making people laugh. I think I'm just a goofy person, which wasn't always good with my tennis. My tennis coach was probably like, can you be serious for a second? This is serious business. So it was a natural kind of progression into realizing I'm good at editing. I'm funny. And for stand-up comedy, that's actually really helpful to get seen in the business if you can start editing your own clips. And I feel like I have the work ethic of a Badger.
Now, were you first doing, like, videoing yourself doing funny stuff and putting it on social media, or did you start with live stand-up and then take clips from that? What was your entry point?
So I actually started working for this, like, media company where they were looking for a video producer. There was not a lot of people working there. And they asked me, could I create these like SNL type sketches every week? And I really had no experience, but I knew how to make like the millennial women laugh, which now has moved to other generations. But I was able to kind of just say, yes, I'll figure it out. And I found some like wedding videographer to film for me. And we started making funny videos. And then I started to meet stand-up comedians through these videos because I would cast them in New York City. And then I started to realize like, oh, I love this community. And kind of it was a dare to do some stand-up because I've been writing so many jokes. And it really was, I kind of fell into it. It was never a goal. But I realized, you know, tennis and comedy are not so different. You're out there alone. You're traveling a lot, battling your own demons. So honestly, being a tennis player at Wisconsin made me, I think, excel quickly in the comedy community because I had that previous experience of like a full career before I started this.
That's interesting. So I talk in the media and I think of myself as being pretty funny. Don't ask my coworkers to confirm that. But one of the scariest things in the world to me seems like it would be doing stand-up and being in front of people and being alone and living or dying by their response. What was that first experience like? As you say, that tennis background helped you, but what was that first experience like being up in front of people instead of in front of a camera and trying to make them laugh?
Yeah, not to turn this into a mental health podcast, but everything is truly perspective. And like, I'm 33 from New York City. I just got my driver's license last week. I know, big deal. But I'm terrified of driving. Like, that's my fear, where I feel like most people can drive. But like talking in front of 2,000 people for whatever reason doesn't trigger anything in me. But I feel like after tennis, like tennis was a lot of pressure. Serving against Duke, second serve, third set, your whole teammates, all your teammates are watching you. That was nerve-wracking to me. So comedy to me is a little more creative, and it's not so much of like a win or a loss. And when I first got on stage that first time, I thought I might feel nervous, like I was hitting second serve, but I actually felt quite calm. And I think that's what you have to chase in this life, is the things that for whatever reason you feel like you fit in. So I weirdly feel comfortable on stage, and I've kind of just been leaning into that.
Hannah Berner is with us, UW-Madison grad, comedian. Her special We Ride at Dawn is on Netflix, coming to Wisconsin again in late October. Hannah, I've been watching a lot of your videos, and a lot of what you do is kind of person on the street interviews, or in your stand-up, you do a lot of crowd work where you're talking to people. That's a special kind of comedy, right? Because, you know, you're not going to your pre-written jokes in those moments. You are taking the material given to you and reacting with it. How do you train on that? How do you develop that skill?
Honestly, I think I get bored easily, and I'm always working on my material, but I don't want to post it to burn the jokes. So when you're on stage, you're kind of like, it's kind of more fun to mix it up. And I kind of love the challenge of seeing someone in the front and finding a way to make it funny. And it's funny because some people, that's their favorite part of the show, being like, how'd you come up with that? But it really is like a trained skill where I'm starting to actually be able to look at people and know how long they've been together with their significant other based on how they're sitting, what job they're doing, they have based on what they're wearing. Like, it's becoming a little psychic. But ultimately, it's what is fun for me to do on stage. And I think if the audience sees me having fun, they have more fun.
Hannah, in one of your Woman on the Street interviews, you asked men to explain why women aren't funny, based on, I guess, very common internet comments from men dismissing women as comedians. What's up with that? Why is that such a common thing for men, at least online, to feel like they got to say that?
I mean, I do think, obviously, we're all speaking from our experience, so some people will connect more with people who are similar to them. But I also think men can get kind of scared thinking that a woman's funny. So it's like their biggest fear. Where I actually think the best relationships between men and women are when we're roasting each other and being silly and having fun. Laughter is my love language, and that's what's worked out for me and my husband. But it is just funny, the internet. There's something about a woman holding a microphone that could sometimes make men be like, I don't trust this girl.
Okay, on tour, and you're coming back to Wisconsin in a bit. Is there a difference between a Hannah Berner New York City set versus a Hannah Berner Wisconsin set?
I do have to say my most specific show is definitely my show when I'm in Wisconsin.
Why is that?
When I step on stage, I love doing local material. And a lot of cities I go to, I don't have local material. But I swear to God, some of the times I've come to Madison, the first 20 minutes is just me riffing on my specific experience in Madison, and having the crowd laugh and understand is my favorite part. Going to Madison and talking about, whether it's from the football players to Bucky to Witty to anything, I get pretty specific on stage, and I feel like it's like my second home. So yes, going to my show at the Orpheum is very specific for Badgers.
Hannah, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great tour.
Thank you guys so much. Bye.
That was comedian and UW-Madison graduate Hannah Berner. Her special, We Ride at Dawn, is on Netflix. Her tour will bring her to Madison and Green Bay in late October.
Wisconsin Today is headed to the movies over the next couple of weeks.
We'll meet a Wisconsin screenwriter who's been a big part of the Jurassic Park franchise and others.
And we'll talk to the owner of a drive-in theater in Door County.
And we want to hear your drive-in movie experiences. Do you go to see movies at one of Wisconsin's remaining drive-ins?
Or do you have memories to share about drive-in theaters back in the day? Either way, email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call and you can leave a message or text. The number is 888-642-0232. Rob, do you have any drive-in memories?
I remember a double feature. Smokey and the Bandit was part one. I think The Sting was part two. I was pretty young. I slept through most of The Sting or whatever the second movie was.
Understandable. Again, share your drive-in memories, sleepy or not. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Colleen Leahy, and Mackenzie Crummy. Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful.
Tim Peterson is managing producer, and Dean Kinetter is our executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.